Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at ungreatjsgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. We're going to bring you the Thursday Morning Show in just a moment. Stay tuned. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very excited to be speaking, first of all, with Nan Calvert, who's joining us for her monthly visit to the program. Good morning, Nan.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good to have you here. And via the wonders of Skype,
yes,
we have joining us a very special guest by the name of Marla Garrison, who is a biologist who lives and works in McHenry County, Illinois. And Nan, say a quick word about Marla Garrison and why you are so excited for her to join us today.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is that I, you know, it's kind of a personal thing. I just adore dragonflies and damselflies. And so that's one reason. And Marla is an expert in those things, also known as odonates. And so she's actually doing a field trip for us in September through the Natural Resources Foundation. She's our very special guest speaker
at CINO
Conservancy, yes. And so it's just really wonderful to have someone here who knows about these amazing insects and what they do and what we can do in order to support their habitat and their survival.
Very good. So Marla Garrison teaches at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois. She sits on the Executive Council of the Dragonfly Society of the Americas, and she has a book called Damselflies of Chicagoland, which that's been published, I think you said, under the auspices of the Chicago Field Museum. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Good morning, Greg. Good morning, Nan.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Before we get into what sounds like your first love, which is dragonflies and damselflies, let's get a little more sense of who you are, of where you come from originally, and at what point you became so interested in the natural world around you and its creatures, and in particular, dragonflies.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I teach in McHenry County, which is on the border with Wisconsin. So there's some guilt by association. You have to claim me as a Wisconsin wannabe. And And by education and training, I am a molecular microbiologist. However, over a dozen years or so ago, I attended a Great Lakes Odonata meeting, and I met several Wisconsin special individuals. In fact, Wisconsin home grows some human treasures, such as Bob Dubois from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and Ken Tennyson, an entomologist in Wisconsin. I met both of them at that time, and they are just consummate teachers, gentle souls, and incredible mentors. And they are actually the reason that I got into the odonate world. I had started looking at damselflies, which are diminutive dragonflies, and I attended that meeting in order to learn more about them. And so with Ken's and Bob's support, I have enlarged my knowledge and understanding of them. And to study a single group of any animal is a wonderful way to learn more and understand more about taxonomy and evolution.
So
through the years, that's what I've been working with. Mm-hmm.
So what work were you doing at the time that prompted you to attend this conference devoted to odonates, which is the term for dragonflies and damselflies? I mean, why was that even on your radar screen at that time?
It's a bit convoluted, but I was actually volunteering to do some molecular work in the lab at the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum in Chicago. And they're part of the Chicago Academy of Sciences. I was working under Doug Tarrin, who's the curator there. And during that process, I was introduced to, I was working on butterfly genetics, and I had become a butterfly monitor in Chicagoland. And while working down at the museum, there was an individual that was studying dragonflies. And so I started looking at them and going out in the field and photographing and using digital photography to come back home and identify to species what I could.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit more about this term odonate. I know that typically when we have a term like that, it maybe refers to something very, very specific. Can you take that term apart for us a little bit?
Sure. The suborder of insects that dragonflies and damselflies belong to, I'm sorry, the order of insects to which they belong is known as the order Odonata. And if you break that down in Latin, it means toothed ones, because this insect order, they are completely carnivorous in all stages of their life cycle, and they have an amazing set of mouth parts with some pretty ferocious looking teeth on them.
So that's what sets them apart from the butterflies, yes, and fruit flies and other creatures that fly through the air.
Exactly.
And it's kind of intriguing that, at least at a glance, it appears to be a relatively small order, in that odonates are dragonflies and damselflies. And there are certain orders where it seems like it's a longer list of different kinds of insects that actually belong to that. So is it a relatively straightforward order? And is there much variation, for instance, within dragonflies and damselflies?
It's true. It's a relatively small order of insects. I think worldwide there's just under 6,000 species, if you consider both dragonflies and damselflies. Within that order, it's broken down into two suborders. Some would say three suborders now. But the Anisoptera are the dragonflies, and the Zygoptera are the damselflies. And there's about 3,000 species of each of those worldwide. So it's very reasonable. If you look at something like Coleoptera, the beetles, there's how many hundreds of thousands of species of those in the world. So if you're going to study an insect, it's always good to pick a small order, something that you in your lifetime can actually become exposed to and observe. Wow. And so odonates are wonderful in that regard. Also, they're extremely visible. flying during the day, so you don't have to stay out late at night. You don't have to put up a mercury vapor lamp. You don't have to get up early in the morning. So during waking hours, they're on the wing, and that makes them a really wonderful group to study.
They're not a reclusive insect.
Not usually.
Nan, you had mentioned right at the top that you are having Marla Garrison come to CINO because you're one of the providers of some field trips. Is it that CINO is overrun with dragonflies? Is that the connection there, that this seemed like a great idea?
Oh, would that it were. We were overrun. That would be fantastic. I think we have a fairly normal population of dragonflies and damselflies. We have good habitat for both of them. And it is not such a common field trip as, say, a birding field trip or looking for toads and frogs. And yet both dragonflies and damselflies, as Marla said, you know, they're out there during the day for us. And they're such miraculous creatures, particularly dragonflies, in terms of what they can do in the air. And the fact that they are completely carnivorous, and yet, you know, it's not like being chased down the trail by a deer fly. They're not going to, you know, it isn't, you know, they're not aggressive towards humans like a German yellow jacket or something of that nature. And they're just, they're so fascinating and they're so beneficial, you know, eating mosquitoes and things that we don't really want around so much.
Well, and they're sizable enough that you really see them. It's not just that they're not reclusive or nocturnal, but you can spot a dragonfly fairly easily, and that also makes it fun, especially for youngsters who are out and about. If you're going to do a flea field trip, you're probably going to have trouble holding their attention, I should think.
Right, and you know, there's such a wide range of size between damselflies and dragonflies, and appearances vary greatly, and their life cycle is so fascinating too, and Marla will talk about that some, I'm sure. So you can take kids from the time that they spend in the water, which for dragonflies can be quite some time, all the way till they're flying around overhead and landing on beautiful native plants. And yeah, it's just fascinating. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show. And joining us via Skype is Marla Garrison, who is a biologist in McHenry County, Illinois. She teaches at McHenry County College, and she is an expert on odonates, which are dragonflies and damselflies. Well, Marla, ahead of us talking about the life cycle of the dragonfly, which would be a great place to go next, I think it would be interesting to look at kind of the long-term history, and maybe that's slightly out of your primary field of focus, but I'm prompted to ask you this because I know I've seen drawings and paintings and so on that would seek to depict prehistoric Earth with, creatures that no longer are with us. And almost always in some of those pictures, we'll see things that look like dragonflies. Do we know a whole lot about just how long a history they have here on planet Earth?
We know quite a bit because we do have fossilized specimens of a stem group of dragonfly-like creatures that were flying during the late Carboniferous period, during the Pennsylvanian portion of the Carboniferous period, about 325,000 years ago. And they were called griffin flies. They were enormous. It was during a time when the earth was covered in swampy cycad forests and ferns. And these were the top predators. They had wingspans up to 27 inches. By comparison, the largest odonates we have today are the helicopter damselflies down in the tropics, and they have about a 7-inch wingspan. So these were enormous bugs. And so they seem to have died out either in the late Carboniferous or early Permian period. They were a stem group, so descended from a common ancestor of our true dragonflies, which showed up in the early Permian period, probably around 275 million years ago. So true dragonflies made their appearance about then. And if we go through the Permo-Triassic extinction, which is when I think they say over 90% of all life forms on Earth became extinct. The true dragonflies didn't. They made it through that massive extinction event.
Wow.
And then they radiated out during the Triassic and the Jurassic time. So if you were walking around a Jurassic Park today, if you could go back in time and walk around a true Jurassic park, you would actually be able to identify to the family level just about every dragonfly you saw.
Wow. So it's an ancient insect then in
that
respect.
It is. Wow. Absolutely.
Huh. One more thing to find fascinating in it. So Nan was saying something about the life cycle of the typical dragonfly or damselfly. This is something I don't know anything about. I don't even know enough to think to ask about such a question. So talk us through the life cycle of the typical dragonfly or damselfly. Or is it hard to generalize?
Yeah, they have most things in common. There's a few differences, but they are aquatic insects first and foremost, which means they spend most of their time in a larval state called a nymph or a naiad in the water. And this period varies depending on species. So some species may go through their entire life cycle in 6 weeks. For some damselflies, for example, and some may take up to 6 years. And most of that time is spent underwater as nymphs. So when the eggs hatch, the larvae are usually either fall into the water or they hatch underwater. And from that point on, they go through a series of growth stages called stadia. And each, so they molt, much like a caterpillar sheds its skin to enlarge. And while they're underwater, they're feeding. They feed when they're very, very small on protozoa and midge larvae and so forth. And as they get larger, some dragonfly nymphs will even feed on minnows and tadpoles.
Wow.
They may even pull snails out of their shells. They're voracious predators in this larval state. They have a remarkable adaptation on their lower jaw. Their lower jaw juts forward a remarkable length, sometimes as much as a third of their body length or
wow.
more. And they have at the end of that lower jaw a couple of pincers, and they can snag their prey that way and pull it back to the remaining jaw parts where all the teeth are. And then they just macerate it like a garbage disposal.
It's so, like the creature from the Alien movies.
It does.
It's actually, it's so true. I'm positive Men in Black use dragonfly larvae in their design. But the larvae themselves are more remarkable in the way they breathe. Dragonfly larvae breathe through their rectum. And so they bring water in through their rectal opening and they push it back out, and they're constantly circulating water through there because they have internal rectal gills, and that's how they bring the oxygen in. They can also use it to jet propel, so when they expel the water, it pushes them forward and they can evade predation and so forth. Sometimes when I dip net them and I bring them out of the water, they squirt me in the eye.
Wow.
With out their rear end. So, and then damselfly larvae, they differ somewhat. They have three what we call caudal gills, and they look like leaves hanging off their abdomen, and they can use them to locomotion, but they also use them to respire, as well as other areas on their body. So that is how they're breathing underwater, and they're growing, and eventually they get to the point where they're in their final instar or final growth stadium, and at that point they're ready to emerge from the water. They crawl up usually on emergent plants. For dragonflies, it's oftentimes early in the morning before the sun is up. Damselflies are less tied to a single time, and many of them will emerge throughout the day. They'll crawl up there and they crack through the cuticle on the dorsal part of their thorax, and they push themselves up out of that skin, and then they grab a hold of the emergent plant or the rock, whatever they're on, and pull their abdomen out and their wings out. And at that point, they pump the equivalent of blood. It's called, in insects, it's called hemolymph, and they pump that into their wings and their abdomen to expand them. So when you first look at a nymph, you're like, how could an adult dragonfly be in there, in that tiny little casing? But when you see them emerge and they begin to expand their wings and abdomen, you can see how it was all kind of telescoped into that skin, or they're known as exuvi.
Huh. How long a process is that, by the way, when they emerge and do this sort of pumping process of the wings?
So I've had them emerge in my hand in 5 minutes, but it can take longer than that in certain species for certain. But I know a friend of mine sent me a picture of a damselfly nymph that had crawled up on a frog that was stationary at the edge of a pond and had emerged while the frog just sat there and didn't move. So it must be fairly quick.
Wow.
for some species.
You know, I'm glad you talked about the larvae of the dragonflies and damselflies, because I think for a lot of people like me who are really ignorant about most matters of the natural world, we think of larvae, if we think of them at all, as completely stationary, sort of tepid creatures. I mean, like the thing that is dormant in a chrysalis waiting to emerge, and we don't think about it doing anything or going anywhere or eating anything. And I think we tend to think of larvae in that way, and it sounds like we shouldn't think about these larvae that way at all.
I think you're right. The larvae have to eat to continue. And when you think about a chrysalis in a butterfly, that's called the pupal stage or the pupae. And pupae are much more, as you described, in terms of you don't think of them as being very active. And dragonflies and damselflies, they don't go through that pupal stage. They skip that altogether. So they go from egg to larva to adult. And so if you think of a butterfly, it goes from egg to larva, known as a caterpillar, to chrysalis, which is the pupal stage, to adult. So dragonflies, they skip that.
Right. So the larvae that we're talking about here is more like the caterpillar for a butterfly. And when you think about how voracious the typical caterpillar is, this shouldn't be a surprise then that these larvae are also the creatures that they are.
And correct. I think one thing, people are always astounded when you're able to pull a dragonfly larva or nymph out of the pond, because most people regard dragonflies and damselflies as really beautiful insects. But when you see the nymph in real life, and it's this rather large, scary-looking underwater insect, people are astounded that a dragonfly can come out of that. How can that possibly happen? Particularly when this thing is completely carnivorous. It's a great hunter, and you pull those jaws out. You know, people kind of, you know, fall back in horror. They don't even want to go in the water anymore.
I bet Marla doesn't, though, right?
I'm actually working on a field guide for dragonfly larvae, so I have a certain love of them.
Right. How large are they? And can you describe their appearance? I mean, for those of us who probably have seen one but didn't realize we saw one, I mean, what do they actually look like?
So their sizes can range. The very smallest of dragonfly larvae is in Wisconsin, is the elfin skimmer. And it's about 1.5 to 2 centimeters long. And the very largest in Wisconsin is known as the dragon hunter. And it's about 4 centimeters long. And it looks, and it's very wide. And it looks like their oak leaf or their leaf mimics. So they blend in with the detritus under the ground or under the water, excuse me. And so they are quite cryptic. They come in different shapes and sizes, but they all have heads with short antennae coming off of them. They have usually rounded or oblong bodies and 6 legs, because they are insects, and their 3 pairs of legs extend off the body. Sometimes they're extremely long, and I'll tell you, there's one group of larvae known as the cruisers. And they look, to give you a visual analogy, if you ever saw Harry Potter and you ever saw the scene where they are in dark arts class, and there's a spider-like creature that Mad-Eye Moody is manipulating.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
what dragonfly larvae look like
Wow.
sometimes.
Ooh.
That's what the cruisers look like anyway.
Right.
But they are very specific, substrate specific. So in the water, you don't find the same larval assemblage in every body of water. And just about every freshwater body of water that you can think of on Earth has a subset of dragonfly larvae that have specifically adapted to it.
And how long did you say this is, in terms of a dragonfly's full lifespan? How long, how great a portion of their lifespan is spent in this interesting larval stage?
Well, there are, in some damselflies, like spreadwing damselflies, they may go through that larval stage in 6 weeks to 2 months in the summertime. Others may take, I would say for dragonflies, the larval stage in Wisconsin is oftentimes 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
And I work with a dragonfly. I've been doing surveys with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this summer on the only federally listed endangered species of dragonfly known as the Heinz Emerald dragonfly, and it flies in Wisconsin and Illinois. And its larval stage is anywhere from 4 to 7 years.
Wow.
It has a very, very specific habitat of groundwater seeps or springs flowing over dolomite, shallow dolomite bedrock. So it has a very, very specific aquatic habitat, and it stays in that aquatic habitat for upwards to 7 years. I think the average is about 4.5 years.
We're speaking on today's morning show not only with our good friend Nan Calvert, but with Marla Garrison, who is a biologist in McHenry County, Illinois, an expert, as you can tell, on dragonflies and damselflies, otherwise known as odonates. And she's going to be a special guest of the Seno Nature Center in September. She will be the sort of headliner for one of the field trips that Seno is offering to the community. So once the dragonfly or damselfly leaves larval stage and becomes then a full-fledged adult, where do they tend to live and what do they tend to do?
So there's basically only two things they do as an adult, and that is eat and mate. And they have to get that done in a very short time span. So they only live as adults, I would say anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, and that depends on predation and weather. They are not specific in terms of habitat, terrestrial habitat, as they are for aquatic habitat. So the plants usually and trees surrounding a water system are not as important to adult dragonflies as, say, the substrate or the amount of water flow or the physical properties of the water in which the larvae developed. So adults are less demanding of specific terrestrial habitats. They spend their time when they first come out of the larval shell. They are said to be tenerals. They have wet wings and wet bodies, and they really need to dry up before they can fly well and evade predation. So that's kind of a vulnerable time for them. And they'll spend a few hours by the water as they emerge, and then they'll fly up away from the water habitat in order to dry out and mature. And it may take females a week or two to develop eggs and become sexually mature. The males usually return to the water, oftentimes to set up territorial patrols and wait for the females to come down, and then they mate. And their mating system is second to none in the animal world. In fact, they have some adaptations that have never been seen in any other animals on Earth for mating.
Tell us more.
So as insects, they have a three-part body, a head, a thorax, and an abdomen, and three pair of legs. Their abdomen, however, is 10 segments long, and it's extremely elongated. So it's stretched way behind their bodies. That poses problems when they go to mate, because the testes where the sperm are produced are in segment 9 on the male towards the end. He has on segment, coming off segment 10, a set of what we call claspers, and they look like a vice grip. Mm-hmm. And each species has slightly different claspers, so it helps somewhat with mate recognition. But in general, those claspers can grab a hold of a female and hold on tight. The female has at the end of her abdomen an ovipositor or her general orifice. And then, so if you picture these two very long abdomen insects trying to mate, backing up to each other would be quite awkward. So what the male does is he uses his claspers to grab the female, if it's a dragonfly, behind the eyes, if it's a damselfly, on the neck region, and he hangs on to her using those claspers, and then he transfers from segment 9, the sperm he's got, to segment 2, and under segment 2 of his abdomen is a natural wonder. It is it's what they call the secondary genitalia, and only odonates have this. It is basically all of the reproductive apparatus for transferring sperm to the female. It's a bit like a Swiss Army knife in all of its utility. It even has the equivalent of a spoon, where it can scoop out sperm from previous matings and displace sperm. And so he curls his abdomen around, he transfers sperm to a vesicle in segment 2, and then the female curls her abdomen around, and they get into what we call the wheel position, and she engages that secondary genitalia, and then he, if he has the ability, he removes the sperm from the previous mating and puts his in, and they mate anywhere from 10 seconds in some dragonflies to an hour in some damselflies. So it's variable. And much of that time is spent in removing sperm from prior matings. And then it's time to oviposit.
And then the romance begins. Huh?
So when they're curled around like that, if they're damselflies, they actually take on, they look like Valentine's Day hearts. It's kind of a neat shape.
Wow. Amazing. And of course, this is something that at a glance you can see, but Of course, to just the casual glance, we're not seeing the intricacy of what's being accomplished and the wonder that you're describing.
Yes, but you can, if you're very careful, you can walk up to it and you can see it in detail. A lot of times people will see two dragonflies in tandem. That's where the male's still connected to the female and they're flying across a pond. And it looks like this big whomping dragonfly or insect. And it's actually two dragonflies still in tandem after they mate. Because after they mate, males oftentimes will mate guard and they'll stay attached to the female. Or they'll fly around her as she lays her eggs. In dragonflies, the female will dip down and she'll tap the surface of the water to deposit eggs. In damselflies, the male stays attached to the female, and he's said to be in sentinel position. His abdomen's very rigid. He looks like a stick. She works her way down an emergent stem into the water and injects her eggs into the vegetation.
Wow. And there they go.
Yeah.
Whew. So we've talked about the voraciousness of dragonflies, not only in their larval stage, but I think also as full-fledged adults. They are carnivorous and they eat a lot. What do they eat? And by and large, are they beneficial to us in what they eat?
Sure. Dragonflies are wonderful at eating mosquitoes. I've read somewhere that they can eat upwards to 200 mosquitoes a day, a single dragonfly. And when you're walking in the woods in June in Wisconsin, it's always nice to have dragonflies flying around your head and picking off the mosquitoes and deer flies, because they like the deer flies as well. So as adults, dragonflies and damselflies take out flying insects usually. They'll also glean some insects off stems, but they're remarkable at sighting prey in the air and maneuvering to the prey and capturing them. They take them with their mouths. If they're larger prey, they hold them with the catch net of the spines on their legs. And they'll eat oftentimes on the wings. Sometimes they'll perch and munch. The larval stages will eat mosquito larvae as well. So they're good to have around for that reason. They oftentimes eat each other. Dragonflies love to eat damselflies, and if they're smaller than them, eat other dragonflies. And there's damselflies too that will eat other damselflies. And there's several species that will actually cannibalize each other. In the larval stage, many nymphs will eat other nymphs of their own species if they're smaller than them.
Is that something, do we know, that's done out of necessity? I mean, when there's nothing else to eat, do they do that? Or is that just hardwired as a fairly normal behavior?
I think it's hardwired. They are pretty indiscriminate, and they're generalist in terms of food. There's only a species or two of dragonflies that are specific, and they're in the tropics, and they're spider eaters. And so they fly into webs and grab spiders. But other than that, and it's specific, but other than that, they're pretty generalist. So I would say they are hardwired.
Nans, they obviously don't eat people. And Nan made it sound like they don't even tend to bother people. And come to think of it, I can't ever remember being bothered by a dragonfly. Are there any species of dragonfly that seem interested in people or that would bite a human if given the chance?
There are none that I know of. In fact, they will avoid hitting you. If it looks like they're coming towards you and you need to duck, you don't need to duck. They are incredible visual creatures. They have these phenomenal compound eyes. They use vision almost exclusively to catch their prey, to find proper habitat to oviposit in and so forth. And so they're very, very good. They're aeronautical engineers. They can maneuver so well, and they will avoid hitting you at all costs. They don't bite unless you are taking them out of a net and you pinch their legs or you're molesting them when you're removing them from the net. And I have been bitten by dragonflies, don't get me wrong, but it's because I've been bothering them. Hmm. They would never fly out of the air and bite you. For no good reason. They, in fact, a number of years ago, I was along the lakeshore in Chicago up in Evanston at Northwestern, and I was walking along the bike trail there, and there happened to be a migration of green darners coming through, and they fly along ridge lines and geographical ridges like lakeshores and mountain ranges when they migrate. And they were coming in by the thousands, and they just appeared out of nowhere. And the bicyclists and the people walking and jogging, they started screaming and running. They just totally dispersed because these enormous insects were so ever present in the air. And I stood there, and I must have seen, you know, a thousand common darner, green darners were flying past me, and they were flying right up to my face and moving around me. They're just incredible navigators. Not a single one touched me.
Wow.
Marla, can you talk a little bit about the how maneuverable dragonflies are, how amazing they are in terms of their flight capabilities compared to other insects and even birds?
Sure. In fact, dragonflies are considered to be the best at aerial acrobatics of just about any animal in the world. There's a species or two of swallows, I think, that they compare them with. But other than that, they reign supreme in the air. And the reason is because of their anatomy. They have four wings attached to the top of their thorax, and each wing is attached to an individual muscle. Directly, it's a direct connection. So they are, they each wing has autonomy and can maneuver by itself in a different direction entirely than the other three wings. That's not something you see in insects generally. If you think of a housefly, when it beats its wings, they all beat together at once, and usually they have to move their thorax because it's the muscles in the thoracic chamber that are contracting, moving the thorax, and the wings are attached to the thorax, so they move. They move as a result, but that's not the situation with dragonflies. In fact, dragonflies were used as models or paradigms for early aeronautics.
What's the largest dragonfly in terms of wingspan?
The largest dragonfly is known as a petal tail, and it lives in Australia. And it has about a 16 centimeter wingspan, I'm guessing. For body mass in North America, the largest dragonfly is the dragon hunter. But for general size, because there's several ways you can measure size, there's one that's called Anax walsinghami, and I cannot remember its common name, but it flies out west. And it's probably 1.5 times the size of a green darner.
Wow.
So if you picture a green darner, if you know what that is, then you get an idea. And the smallest dragonfly is the elfin skimmer in the United States. There's one smaller in Japan, but it is basically the size of a bee.
Wow.
Gosh.
That would really be something to see. You'd think your eyes were playing tricks on you. Now, what eats dragonflies?
Other dragonflies will eat dragonflies. Birds will eat dragonflies and frogs. If they go into oviposit, frogs will eat damselflies. Waterfowl will eat damselflies. In the larval stage, waterfowl are big consumers of dragonfly larvae, as are fish and frogs. Let's see. The damselflies. And I never described the difference between a dragonfly and a damselfly. Damselflies are the gracile, small, delicate members of the odonate order. And they usually fly in a much weaker way down low amidst the vegetation. And so as a result, one of the trappings that occurs is grass spiders or orb weavers that spread wings across the grass blades will trap a great number of damselflies in their webs. So they're another predator.
So how well are damselflies and dragonflies doing in terms of their numbers? It seems like their numbers are robust. Are they under any kind of threat?
I think that the dragonflies, their populations are very difficult to study. You can't study them through observation of adults very easily. So I would say that population studies are few and far between on dragonflies to answer that question adequately. However, there are dragonflies that are doing very well as a result of human development. One of them is known as the Eastern Pond Hawk, and it seems to colonize every detention basin that's built by a developer behind every townhome park and so forth. And so they move in. There's what I call the Dirty Dozen in Chicagoland, which are I shouldn't do that, but they're very common species, and they colonize these man-made ponds very quickly. I think the biggest threat to dragonflies right now is the destruction of unique aquatic habitats. So when you've got seeps and springs and you've got clean, pristine rivers and you've got fishless wooded streams and ephemeral vernal pools and so forth that are drying up or being rerouted or being eroded as a result of the hydrologic changes that come along with development, then you see certain species of dragonflies and damselflies diminishing. There's been some concern with a few species of late and their numbers going down. There's some very rare species of dragonflies and damselflies, and rare because their habitats just are disappearing.
Let's finish up by hearing about some of the research projects that you have done, the kind of studies in which you are engaged.
Well, most of my research in dragonflies and damselflies is not, I wouldn't say, it's certainly not laboratory research, it's surveys. So I have worked extensively with the McHenry County Conservation District and their lead ecologist, Matt Isles. We conducted 3 years of dragonfly surveys through the county at their natural sites. And we expanded the checklist tremendously. When we started, they didn't know, for example, there's a group of dragonflies called clubtails, and they thought they had 2 clubtails in the district. By the time we were done, we knew that they had 8, possibly 9. So I've done surveys there. I work with the Winnebago County Forest Preserve District and developing some citizen science workshops and programs for dragonfly surveys. And those citizen scientists every week are discovering the presence of dragonflies that they didn't know were in the county. And that's very important because you need to know what you've got before it's gone, so you know what to protect. I'm headed up to Wisconsin next week, actually, on a project. I'm working with Bill Smith and Ken Tennyson and Dennis Johnson up there on some research and surveys on a group of dragonflies in northern Wisconsin lakes and the parasitism of those dragonflies up there, and trying to determine what the parasite, the species of parasite, it's a worm, is, and how it got there. And so that's some. I work with the, as I mentioned, the Illinois State Museum Society and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with the Heinz Emerald Project as a volunteer on that. And so we've been able to locate new populations of Heinz Emerald dragonfly in Illinois. And that's been exciting. So that's just some of the things I've been working on.
Sounds pretty busy to me.
So dragonflies are absolutely our friends.
Absolutely.
So we need to be good to dragonflies and welcome them wherever they are and do what we can to preserve their habitat.
Agreed. They are friend, not foe.
Very good. Mabel Garrison, a biologist in McHenry County, Illinois. It has been so great to talk with you. Just fascinating to hear about these extraordinary creatures that we take for granted. Although, on the other hand, I think most of us find something really beautiful and majestic about the typical dragonfly. Mm-hmm. But most of us, of course, know absolutely nothing about them. So thank you so much for shedding light on this fascinating creature.
Thanks, Marla.
Been great to talk with you.
Thank you, Greg and Nan. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you again. Thanks for your time. Well, I can tell you're even more excited about this upcoming visit for her.
Yes, I am. I think it's going to be really fantastic. We get to be out in the field with Marla and also in the classroom. And, you know, you just can't come up with a better person to spend time with.
Very good. Well, I don't think you can get your calendar done in 90 seconds, probably. What we will do is record Nan Calvert's calendar of events, and they will air tomorrow on the morning show rather than today. So make sure you tune in tomorrow to the morning show or check out the website, and all of the events which are going on, Nan will be telling you about. Nan, thank you for booking such a fantastic guest, and we look forward to seeing you in September.
It's my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in September as well, Greg.
Very good. Thanks for all of these interesting programs on the morning show. The time is 1 minute before 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's.